So first, let me just say, as usual, how very, very happy I am to be here. I get teary-eyed, actually, less talking about me coming so long ago. And I was actually trying to add up the years, and I realize it's over 30. Some of you might not even be that old, but I'm old. And I first arrived at Kanando in the old building in 1984. And I have never looked back. I found my place when I found my practice. And like most of you probably, you didn't even know you were looking for it. And then you found it. And when you know it, nobody can tell you otherwise. So, in the first few years of my practice, I remember meeting someone who is now a Zen teacher at Stanford, Grace Shirison. And there was this story told about her that I didn't realize was her until much later. But it was about her first encounter with Suzuki Roshi. And apparently, you know, it was in the days of, you know, Haight-Ashbury in the 60s and hippies and dirty feet. And I guess Mrs. Suzuki was, like, outraged when these young people would come with dirty feet into her beautiful, clean tatami house. But Suzuki Roshi was completely in his element. He had left what he knew and came to something that he did not. And he felt, I think, that Zen was not really alive and fresh in Japan at that time. And that here was a new opportunity. So this young woman wearing long flowing skirts and probably scarves and long hair and earrings, I can just imagine Grace in those days, and her friends show up at Sokoji, which was the first place in San Francisco where Suzuki Roshi was actually teaching a Japanese group, parishioners. And he invited them in and showed them around the Zendo and talked a little bit about meditation. And, you know, they were just sort of all blissed out. Oh, wonderful. Oh, meditation. Oh, yes. And then as they were departing, he turned to them and said, so most important thing, you know, in Buddhism, a Buddha says, life is suffering. And Grace said, apparently they walked out and she turned to her friend and said, whoa. What a bummer. I think about this because I know that if you tried to explain to anybody that you knew that one of the core teachings of Buddhism is, you know, the truth of suffering, they would look at you like you were insane. Why would you want to practice such a thing with that start? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. Aren't we here to enjoy and love and, you know? But to me, this message made absolutely perfect sense. I had spent my mid-20s searching without realizing that's what I was doing. I had grown up a Catholic, and even when I was a child, it didn't make any sense to me. Which is not to say there aren't good things about Catholicism. There are. But all of the other stuff that got added on to it didn't make much sense. The core values and beliefs, not bad. But I was finding it hard in my teens to believe in virgin births. That sounded like a good trick if you could get away with it. And it seemed to be a pretty vengeful God, too. Because I was told at a very early age that because my father was not a Catholic, he was going straight to hell. That's a little hard for a young person to hear about a father they love. So as soon as I left home, I left the church. But I realize now, and it's something I actually just told my mother. My mother just entered hospice on Friday. So we had quite the conversation last weekend. And I told her that, oddly enough, one of the things I was most grateful to her for was raising me a Catholic. Because I said, you know, today, so many people have no religious training at all. And so they come to practice, and they don't even know how to begin. And things like bowing and chanting and offering incense, oh, whoa, wait a minute, what's that? Whereas for me as a Catholic, you know, this is just high church. It's very familiar. But more than that, the idea that there are these, you know, in Catholicism they're called commandments, and here we call them precepts, and really you can think of them as guidelines for how to live a life that is not just about the self, that is about how to live with others in harmony, with kindness and respect. Fundamentally, all religions have that in common. So I told my mother how grateful I was that she had brought me up in a religious environment. But in those days, in my early 20s, I couldn't see that. All I could see was the world was going to hell in a handbasket very fast. And my journals are filled with drawings that I now look at and think, boy, I must have been really depressed. And I think part of it was that, you know, I was talking to people who were survivors of the Holocaust and who had survived childhood abuse. It was just like too much, and I couldn't make any sense out of it. But the one thing that kept happening, I was reading. I've always been a great reader, and I was just reading all the time. And every time, you know, somewhere in the middle of it, it'd say, well, and the Zen masters would have said, or Zen master so-and-so said, and these would be in books that were not about Zen, even fictional books. Until finally one day I said, who are these guys? You know, why do they keep talking about them? Because I had never heard of Zen Buddhism. Which may seem very strange. I guess I lived a very sheltered childhood. So the very first book that I picked up was the wrong one. I picked up Zen and Japanese Culture by D.T. Suzuki. And in that book, while it had certainly a lot of information about Zen, it also made it sound like I really had to go to Japan to study it. But of course, this book was written in 1950, I think. So I figured that someday when I, you know, was an adult and had a lot of money, I would finally go to Japan and then I would be able to study Zen. And it just happened. But of course, nothing just happens. That one day, because I was taking a class in the city with a friend, I sat down next to somebody. And we were talking, and I had started a new series of paintings, which in my complete naivete, called Beginner's Mind, based on what I had read in this book. And I was telling her about it, and she looked at me and she said, oh, do you practice? And I'm thinking, I don't think she's asking about piano. And I looked at her and I said, no, why do you? Oh yeah, I go to this place down in Mountain View. Mountain View, California? Oh yeah. The real irony is that this class was two blocks down from San Francisco Zen Center. And so it was the following Wednesday that I came and found this man and one other man standing at the front. One was kind of big, one was kind of small. They were both wearing black robes. And I immediately looked at the skinny guy and said, that's him. And it was. In those days, like most people who come to practice, I wanted something. I don't even think I knew what it was I wanted. But at least I know now I don't want it anymore. But in those days, there was something I wanted. I had gotten all fired up from reading those books. Yeah, because I didn't stop at that one. I started reading everything, and enlightenment. Oh, that sounds good. You know, deep understanding that only some people get. Oh, even better. I could be special. This comes from a very deep and lonely and yearning place in all of us to want to be special, to want to be different, to want to stand out, because we don't actually understand how very unique and special we already are. It comes from a place of not feeling enough. And to me, that is the greatest gift of these 30 years, is finally feeling enough. Just as I am, with all my flaws, with all my character peccadilloes, with everything I do wrong, because I know that I'm always trying to do my best. Even if I fail miserably, that my intention has grown over the years to do the right thing, to be kind, to be attentive, to be aware. And I fail all the time, and it's okay. So there's a famous fascicle by Zen Master Dogen. It's called The Eight Awakenings of Great Beings. I like the title, if nothing else. Great beings. Who would those beings be? Well, you are all great beings. And this is the problem. We're always separating the great beings out from everybody else. Everybody is a great being. My dog is a great being. And how do I know this? Because a great being is one who brings joy to others. That's the only definition you can have. So in this fascicle, he talks about these eight things. And I don't have time to talk about them all, but I'm going to talk about one. The eight awakenings are this. Have few desires. Know how much is enough. Enjoy serenity. Be diligent. Maintain mindfulness. Practice meditation. Cultivate wisdom. And do not engage in hollow discussions. Now, that's rather pertinent right now, I think. But we won't go there. So I know that you already practice meditation because you're here. And I'm pretty sure that you maintain mindfulness because of your practice of meditation. And because of that, I also know that you are diligent, or you wouldn't be here, and that you are probably experiencing serenity. So I don't really need to talk about any of those, but the first two is what I would like to talk about tonight. Having few desires and knowing how much is enough. Because Madison Avenue would have you believe that you not only do not have enough, but that you are not enough yourself. Everything you see, if you'll just buy this product, you'll be happier, you'll be smarter, you'll be more beautiful, you'll look younger, you know? Because you are not enough as you are. We have to fix you to make you enough. And because that is a fundamental human insecurity, they are preying on it. They are counting on it. And we fall for it over and over again. So we have a vow in which we say, desires are inexhaustible. if you listen to your mind very carefully all day long, I want, I want, I want, I want, I want. Oh, I don't want. Oh, but I want. All day long. I want the light to turn green. I want to go and get a cup of tea. Oh, I really don't want that for lunch. All day long. Want, not want, want, not. Desires are inexhaustible and aversion is right there with it. What is the problem with desire? Well, as you know, what I was talking about earlier, the Buddha's first truth is of the truth of suffering, or as it's often really more accurately described, dissatisfaction. And the second truth is about the causes of this. Greed, or thirsting desire, aversion, and delusion. And it is the delusion that gets us in the end. But it is fed by the first two, of our wanting or our not wanting. Because we think those are our only two choices. And we go back and forth on this seesaw all day long. Suffering is the distance between what actually is and the way we want it to be. And you can look at it in really small detail in your life or a really big detail. So in January, my mother had a major stroke. And this vibrant, independent, stubborn, opinionated, lovely woman suddenly turned 180 degrees into a completely helpless person who was paralyzed her entire left side of her body. And I can tell you, she did not want that. So the problem with not wanting is sometimes you can think, well, yeah, I can understand why you wouldn't want that. It's pretty awful. Suffering is a little different, though. To not want something is one thing, but then to just keep not wanting it and wanting it to be different, there will be suffering then. Besides the pain, besides the difficulty. You know, and Suzuki Roshi used to say that, you know, eventually someday maybe you won't have difficulty with your difficulties. But we all do. I mean, let's face it. When hard things like that happen, it's pretty hard to buck up and say, okay, well now I'm paralyzed on half side of my body, what am I going to do now? So suffering is that distance between what is and what we want or don't want. And delusion is believing that you can turn away and it won't matter. Everything matters. So what would be enough? What do you have enough of? I'm always surprised in this particular area, which is incredibly wealthy by standards in the rest of the country, that when you ask anybody, it doesn't matter who they are, do you think of yourself as wealthy? Oh no. These are people making very large 6 to 7 figure incomes and they're not wealthy? When will they be wealthy then? And whose mark are you using? You know, what are you benchmarking against? But it's not enough. It's never enough when that's the way we're focusing our life. We never have enough money. We never have enough time. We never have enough happiness. Everyone tells us that. But really, we never have enough clarity or wisdom or compassion. The human craving, that need to fulfill each and every desire, arises often without reflection. And when that is the case, we're going to suffer. However, at the same time that my mother was going through this paralysis and having to suddenly deal with a life that had turned topsy-turvy on her, another very dear friend of mine was in the second year of chemotherapy for melanoma cancer. I spent 2 years with her. She didn't live here. She lives in Nevada City. Every week, I would send her a card just so she would know I was thinking of her. It had some little quote that I'd found or some words of encouragement, something. They're just small things. But that's what she needed from me. She needed other things from other people, but she wanted me to be the person who would be there at the end with her. And so we just developed this along the way. She had never done Zen meditation. She had never done meditation. And little by little, she started to do it. And as I was telling some people at dinner, one of her therapists gave her this wonderful meditation of, she had three round, smooth rocks that she would put in front of her, because she wasn't used to doing the kind of meditation that we all do. And she would pick up a rock and hold it in her hands until it got warm. And then she would put it down and pick up the next rock. And then the next one. And by using the rock, that became the focus of her meditation, was to warm this cold rock. And she said by the time she'd warmed three rocks, a half an hour had gone by. But I loved the symbolism of it, because what is the human heart sometimes but just giant cold rock? Does not want to open up. And so she was holding it to warm it up, which I think is what we're doing in Zazen. So sometimes in the middle of her incredible difficult time, she told me later, she said she had to go back to NIH for a month in Maryland and be put in a bubble room, because they took all her white blood cells out of her body and then put new ones back in. So, of course, you're in tremendous danger of any kind of bacterial infection or something. She said later it was like being in a war zone, and that one of the things she did to keep up her courage, she had a sack of those cards I'd sent her, and she'd just start going through them in order to have one small moment of joy right here, right now. So those moments of just joy, of ease, of connection, that is actually the state of enough. They aren't usually protracted or even sustainable. The fabulous meal gets eaten. That great ski run finally comes to an end. But true joy, true ease, true connection can exist even in the middle of our difficulty. Even in the middle of saying goodbye to my mother last weekend. I'll see her again before she dies, but she won't know me. But saying goodbye to her, even in the middle of that, I could just feel this incredible joy of having had this amazing relationship with my mother. And how fortunate I know I am, because I know plenty of people who did not have that relationship. And that she could feel joy in the middle of all her pain at that moment, for the love that she had for her children and that they had for her. Sometimes our practice is to start with practicing having enough until finally we begin to realize that we are enough, that being is enough, that no matter what happens to us, whether we get cancer or run over by a car or die in our sleep if we're fortunate, that the mere fact that we are here with each other tonight is enough. And it is so easy to forget that. We go out on the road and we're in our little cars, and so we're anonymous and so is everybody else. But if we could think of everybody out there as your next door neighbor or your neighbor's child or your cousin, everything changes because we make it personal. But actually, a bodhisattva is somebody who makes everybody personal. Everybody who comes in front of you is your responsibility, is your care, is your joy. The core delusion is not about not having enough things, although that drives the vast majority of people's lives. It is the inner feeling of not being enough. It's a hidden agenda. When you come to practice, you realize it pretty quickly. There's this wonderful line that Dogen says, the dharmic, the zazen that I refer to is not zazen, is not meditation. It is the dharma gate of joyful ease. I love that line. How many of us can say that we exist in joyful ease? That no matter what arises, no matter what happens today, tomorrow, what happened last week, that we can come to this moment, right here, right now, and breathe. And how wonderful to be able to breathe. You know, in my own school, I had two different children who had cystic fibrosis. You cannot breathe. We take so much for granted. It's always amazing to me all the things that can go wrong with your body. I just found out about a friend who, there's something wrong with her cartilage. The cartilage isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. And I'm thinking, I don't think about my cartilage. I don't think about my ligaments. I just assume they're there doing what they're supposed to be doing. It never dawns on me that something's got to happen for them to be there and doing that. In the same way that I don't really think about the circulation in my body until something goes to sleep. Or like last night, I wake up with terrible cramps in my feet because apparently they're not getting enough blood flow. And then you think, oh dear, I'm getting old. And the funniest thing about that, when you work with very young children, they have no idea what you're talking about. One day I had some kids leaning over my desk and we were talking and I said, well, you know, eventually as you get old enough, things begin to wear out. Wear out? What do you mean wear out? I said, well, you know, the body's like a car. And, you know, for the first 10 years of a car's life, everything's running just great. And then eventually the transmission goes and the brakes start going and you got to get a new set of tires. But there are some things you actually can't fix and eventually you just got to let the car die. Oh, their little eyes got wide. I said, you know, the heart only lasts so long. This was an idea that had never occurred to them. And I hope maybe they thought about it a little bit. But you know, young people, they don't have to think about these things most of the time. Their bodies heal like that. They have lots of energy. The problem also with this feeling of not enough is the true cause of suffering. It creates separation. It appears that we first feel separate from others because we have this endless litany of comparisons. Well, I'm not as beautiful as she is, and I'm not as smart as he is, and I'm not as, you know, religious as he is, or whatever it is. Whatever in your mind is important. And this is an old thing from childhood, you know. We do this. We compare ourselves. But actually, that's only the secondary effect of separation. We're never really completely satisfied with this one here. And so the cruelest blow is that we feel separated inside. And then we're never fully able to accept ourselves, even if on the outside everyone is telling us how wonderful we are. Have you ever had that situation with a friend where they think they're really awful or terrible or whatever it is, and you keep saying, oh no, and they won't believe you? Well, that's because it's inside that matters. And thank goodness this is what practice is so good for. You sit here in silence and things arise. You're not even trying to make them arise, they just very naturally do. And I will say that in the first 5 years of practice, I spent the first 6 months in total bliss, and wow, this is just the greatest thing since sliced bread. Oh my goodness, it's amazing, and I want to do more and more of this. And from then on, it was downhill for years. I remember one time, I don't even think I ever told Les this. You know how when you have sashim, you use whatever left over from breakfast and lunch to make the gruel for dinner. And for one sashim, I made this beautiful potato soup. And we served it for lunch. And there was quite a bit left over, so I was assuming I would be taking that home, only to discover that this relatively new person had taken my beautiful soup and made gruel out of it. I was incensed. In fact, I was more than incensed. As I recall, in the evening, sitting in front of the wall, I was so angry that this person had not asked me, at least, about it, or wondered if I might care. And I just remember, it was just feeding itself. I mean, do you know how that is? I mean, no, maybe none of you do. But when you get angry, you start adding a lot of other stuff to it. And you're having this incredible temper tantrum in your head, to the point that I was really tempted. I was just wanting to hit the wall with my fist, because, you know, it wasn't really that far away. And I think the only reason I didn't is I knew it was going to hurt. But the good thing is, after the big dip, then I started coming out of it again. Because it takes a while for all the arisings that you're not happy with to get out of your system. To see yourself very clearly, no rose-colored glasses anymore. To see how you keep thinking you're not enough, but actually the way you phrase it to yourself at first is no one else is enough. It finally dawns on you that maybe it's you who are not enough. And then only much, much later you begin to think, well, maybe I am enough, and maybe so is everybody else. So, how do we work with this? We sit and we watch those thoughts arise, and we try to remind ourselves, you know, don't believe everything you think. Because a lot of that stuff that's coming up, they're just blips on the screen. And it's to the point now when something comes up, I'm like, whoa, where'd that come from? And you can literally say, no, go away. But it takes a long time to discern what's true and what is just, you know, blips on the screen, synapses going. And to finally let that stuff go and come back to what's true. Not to fool yourself, not to inflate yourself, but what actually is. Because only when we can do that can we completely let the self go and stop worrying about it. As long as we do not feel enough, we are still self-concerned. We're still trying to be enough. We're still trying to make that happen. But the glory of Zazen, I think, is that one day, finally, you realize this is it. For good or bad, this is who I am. And I will try my hardest every day. I will do my best. And that is all anyone can ask. And the interesting thing is, whatever you do, if you do with right intention, that is the best you can do by definition. It is the best anyone can do by definition. We bring our intention to do right, and maybe by some abstract standard we don't reach it, but our intention is what informs our practice, what informs our life out there. So, for all of us, I think there are either stories or movies that are iconic in our life, that there was some message there that has stayed with us all our life. And I confess that for me, it is the movie of The Wizard of Oz. There's a great deal of wisdom in that movie. If you haven't seen it, you should. But in the early years when I first watched it, I could hardly watch the screen. I was so scared. When the witch turns from Elmira Gulch into the witch, I always had to do this because it was too scary. But when you think about it, and Dorothy goes off to Oz, and she has these companions. These companions are herself. The Scarecrow is intellect. And the Tin Man is courage. And her heart. And the Lion is courage. And Toto is joy. And the witch is the scary stuff that happens in the world. At the end, you know, she comes back. And remember in the movie, if you've seen it, it goes from black and white in her world to pure color, crazy color, in Oz. And then it comes back to black and white. This is our life, you know? Our ordinary life is just black and white. And then once in a while, there's technicolor, you know, some fabulous thing. And then we go, you know, back to black and white, but it's different when we've had the experience of pure joy and ease, of feeling enough. We come back to the black and white in a completely different way. And Dorothy says this at the end. You know, what is it you learned, Dorothy? Well, I think that if I'm ever searched for my heart's desire beyond my own backyard, I never lost it to begin with. What is your heart's desire? It is why you are here. This is your heart's desire. Your heart's desire is to sit in this peaceful way, to take your calm and clear heart out into that world which desperately needs it. Our heart's desire is finally and forever to feel at ease in this bag of skin and bones, so that when you are in my mother's position and you know it is your final days, that you will be able to go with some sense of ease and joy, and most of all, gratitude. It's an amazing life.